Okay, good. I think that's right. Okay. We've got the story, and then we've got the book. So we'll start with the story. Just jumping right in, because it's a very short story. Predictable, said Judith DaCosta. Oh, hopeful, said her husband Justin, in his determinedly tolerant way. Neither, said Harry Savitsky, not looking for trouble exactly, looking for engagement perhaps, really looking for the door, but the evening had just begun. Okay, so what do we learn about our first three characters?
Nobody wants to be there.
Nobody wants to be there. Right. Okay, great. And welcome back. predictable, right? Said Judith DaCosta. So Judith, when you say predictable, what's behind that? Should have known, it's so obvious, it's like, you know, predictable is not a good thing to be, you know? You know, when we say somebody, you know, or the story is predictable or the person is predictable, you
boring.
Know, usually it's a, yeah, it's either boring or it's, we knew that person has this bad habit and that they would demonstrate it yet again. So there's something of a pejorative in here from the get-go. Judith is a pejorative kind of person. She's ready to put things down, people down, and so on. Justin is determinedly tolerant. What does that tell us about him?
Easygoing. Optimistic.
Gives
yeah,
everything a
trying
chance.
To balance her.
Right.
Has to live with her.
Yes, right. So there, behind his tolerance and his, you know, sort of a little bit more easygoingness is a determination, right? He will be tolerant. Maybe it doesn't come naturally to him to be tolerant, or maybe it's in reaction to his wife, who is not tolerant. But there is, you know, his determinedly tolerant way. So he's... He comes in with his own agenda. Harry Savitsky, not looking for trouble, maybe looking for engagement, really looking for the door. So what about Harry? What you see is what you get, you know. Not in that sense, not that he's not a complex person, but he's very kind of down to earth. He's the one who knows he's looking for the door. Right? He knows he doesn't want to be there. The other two, who knows what they're thinking, right? You know, but it's probably not articulating to themselves. They might be looking down on this or that or that, but they're probably, you know, not able to say to themselves, I should be looking for the door or something. Okay, so, but the evening had just begun, you know, no chance. Harry's wife, Lucienne, uncharacteristically said nothing.
But each observation has a qualifier.
Yes, yes.
So the qualifier is telling you more than the observation.
Yes, yes, yes. Right. So said nothing, meaning, hi, good morning, meaning that usually she does say something and then some. So she was listening to the tune, A Mournful Bit of Smetana. What these four diners were evaluating was a violinist, partly his performance, partly his presence. The new restaurant, Harry and Lucienne had suggested it, called itself the Hussar and presented piroshki and goulash in a gypsy atmosphere. The chef was rumored to be 26 years old. The Hussar was taking a big chance on the chef, on the fiddler, on the location, and apparently on the help. One boss boy had already dropped a pitcher of water. Okay, so they're evaluating their restaurant. So what is it about? So let's think about the restaurant, the setting. For our story for today.
It was recommended by the couple.
Harry and Lucienne, yes.
Yeah, they recommended it. them probably from their experience of being in the old world and wanting to maybe feel familiar there.
Right, right. How do we describe the, how does he describe the, she described the food later on? The food arrives and it's 26 things that could kill you. Right. He's so good. Right, pierogi and goulash and, you know, all the heavy kind of food. Harry looks like, called himself the hussar. What's a hussar? I might be pronouncing it wrongly, but what's a hussar? It's a horseman. It's a cavalry person, a Hungarian cavalry person. So it's probably Hungarian food, right? A 26-year-old chef, and they were taking a big chance, evidenced by the fact that the busboy had already dropped a pitcher of water. So let's keep going. Turn to 218 in the middle. As a schoolgirl in Buenos Aires, as a young working woman, we're talking about Lucienne, in 1950s Boston, she had been known for dressing well on very little money. Mom.
There's a shoe on the side.
Just so you can hear.
Oh, you got it.
Yeah. Okay.
Is this better for
her? I think this is good, yeah. Dressing well on very little money, and she and her brother had managed to support their widowed mother too. But Lucienne was well over 60 now, and perhaps this turquoise dress she'd bought for a friend's grandson's bar mitzvah was too bright for the present company. Perhaps it was also too tight for what Lucienne called her few extra pounds, and Harry called her blessed corpulence. Isn't that great? He was a fatty himself. Okay, so what do we learn about Lucienne?
She has this flair.
She has a flair, right? If anybody has a pretension, you know, has a right to, you know, have some kind of pretension to elegance and grace and so on, it's her, right? She's a Parisian. Never mind that the city was occupied, never mind that, you know, she was hardly taken from the apartment.
And going out to dinner wearing a dress from a bar mitzvah, you know, that from her grandson's bar mitzvah, you know, maybe she was a little overdressed.
could be, right? And what else? Maybe the turquoise dress was too bright for present company. What does that tell us?
They're very stodgy, the company, perhaps.
Yes, they can't handle too much color, right? They prefer colorless, less color, colorless, right? And so too bright and too tight for this company. Too bright, too tight. It's too much visually, and she should be, you know. What's the point of calling it, her clothing too tight? Maybe it was too tight. She doesn't mind. She doesn't mind. You know, something skin tight shows your body, and she's perfectly happy with her body. You know, and
if she was from Buenos Aires, that's how they dress.
Yeah. So. She's fine, Harry's fine, it's the other two that, you know, have a problem with it. This is, okay.
218.
In the DaCosta's disciplined presence, Harry was also always a little embarrassed about their appetites, his and Lucienne's. Certainly they had nothing else to be ashamed of, not a thing. They were well educated, as high school teachers had to be in their day. She taught French, he chemistry. Lucienne spoke three languages, for if you counted Yiddish, Harry conversed only in Brooklyn English. Oh, four if you counted Yiddish, sorry. Harry conversed only in Brooklyn English. I love that. It's a language unto itself. But he understood Lucienne in all her tongues. They subscribed to the New Yorker and Science and American Heritage. So what's the dynamic between them, between the two couples?
You're looking at two different worlds.
Two different worlds.
And
Yeah. And what are some of the differences between that?
That's like the story we read. The message. The message.
Oh, the message, right, right. Right, where two people are kind of just sort of looking past each other, talking past each other. Somehow they communicate. It's not just that Lucien and Harry might enjoy eating. He's getting a vibe that they think that they eat too much, right? So it's not just coming from nowhere. He feels that particular vibe. And it's putting him on the defensive. We don't need to be ashamed of anything, right? But that's a defensive posture. Nothing to be ashamed of. Truth is, they do have nothing to be ashamed of. So she's a chemistry teacher. He's a, what is he, French? She teaches French. He taught chemistry. They speak multiple languages, right? Where the DaCostas?
English.
They probably speak English. So, you know, and they read the New Yorker. So they, yeah.
What do you think about the fact that we don't know as much about the DaCostas?
The next paragraph we're going to hear.
But
yeah.
It does, but it doesn't.
Yes.
It doesn't tell us what they did or do. It tells us what the family derivation is, but...
Well, he's a doctor. And
He's a psychiatrist. He has a full practice, but... No, but the thing is that we're going to hear about them as Jews did when they came to New the World. Is, you know, let me take off that Jewish jacket and marry whenever an Episcopalian is available.
Would have them.
I will marry. Very.
It seems that what he's saying is that they are disciplined, as evidenced by how thin they are, and obviously they watch what they eat. A little uncomfortable with the fact that the possibility that being corpulent means you're undisciplined. So he's rationalizing and saying, so what? We have all these things. We're okay. But
right.
I think he's a little uncomfortable with just that fact because he thinks they're judging him.
Yes, they think. And we do, you know, we make judgments about, you know, people make judgments about people. And, you know, I mean, in the same way that we're becoming very aware that people immediately make judgments when you're of a certain gender, people dismiss other people based on a host of things. And, I think Harry's probably, you know, hearing what they are conveying. So let's go to the DaCostas. These DaCostas, though, they were very tall. They were very thin. Judith, with her pewter hair and dark clothing, could have passed for a British governess. What is that supposed to imply?
Severe.
Proper. Stern. Discipline. By the book, you know.
buttoned up.
Yes, buttoned up, mm-hmm. Right. But note the visual here. They're very tall and they're very thin, meaning that when they're meeting up with the Savitskys, they are, because
like
they're tall, they are
looking
down on them, right? Looking down on them. They just are, right? she could have passed for a British governess. Justin was equally daunting, a high brow, a lean nose, and thin lips always forming meaningful expressions. What does that mean? Always forming meaningful expressions.
Easy to read,
and we'll see that, you know, I think the meaningful expressions, yeah, he wants
attention.
to be less easy to read than he actually is.
Yes, but these are high school teachers. Hmm. They can look at a kid's face and know exactly what's going on under the desk.
Right.
I mean.
Right. So, you know,
mm-hmm. He's trying to look like he's really listening.
Yes, yes. You know, he's trying to, like, convey the empathy, you know, which is, and we'll hear a little bit later that, you know, he's determined with his empathy too, or he's learned how to look empathic. So these meaningful expressions, are they, and they're always forming, not naturally necessarily. They're always forming because he feels like, I want my face to look meaningful. But there were moments when Justin, now when the facade comes down, Justin glanced at Judith while speaking, and a spasm of anxiety crossed his face, getting entangled with the meaningful expressions. Then Justin and Harry briefly became allies, two younger brothers who'd been caught smoking. One morning at breakfast, Harry had described this occasional feeling of kinship to his wife. Lucienne looked at him for a while, then got up and went around the table and kissed him. Why does she kiss him?
Because he's trying. Because he's trying to make a connection and a meaningful relationship with this couple.
So when Justin is anxious about Judith, apparently he's able, it allows him to break free just a little bit to connect with Harry, which is a good thing. And Harry takes it, you know, like, oh, we're two brothers, you know, it's not quite that way, but that's who Harry is, right? He likes to try to find the connections, as opposed to always trying to, you know, create the distance, right? You get the sense that the DaCostas come to this evening by trying to keep the distance. Even though they are now related by marriage. Okay, paprika breadsticks. Mom, do you want to read?
Right.
Yeah.
Paprika breadsticks. The waiter's young hand shook as he lowered the basket. Judith took none. Justin took one but didn't bite. Lucienne took one and began to munch. Harry took one and parked another behind his ear. Ha! Said Judith mirthlessly. Ha ha! Said Justin. Lucienne looked at Harry and sighed and smiled, a wide motherly smile, reminding him of the purpose of this annual evening out. He removed the breadstick, brushing possible crumbs from his shoulder. What do you hear from our kids? He said to Justin.
Okay. What's the breadstick behind the ear?
It's like a cigar.
Yeah. It's a Groucho Marx. It's a, you know, it's like. But then Judith laughs mirthlessly. She's a woman who, even when she is like chuckling, there's nothing laughing about her. Justin is trying a little more, and Harry's ready to be Harry, which is like, you know.
It's an icebreaker. He's trying to just do something.
Something.
And it shows in the previous paragraph that Lucienne's a warm person. She came around and gave him a kiss because these people would not kiss her. I mean, that's the kind of person she is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes, very much so. So he goes to safer territory. What do you hear from the kids? Smart guy. Julie, do you want to keep reading here?
Our kids love it out there in Santa Fe. I don't share their taste for the high and dry, Justin said with an elegant shrug. You're a Yankee from way back, said Harry.
Okay, just pause here just for a quick second. What's the high and dry?
The
mountains and the desert, right? Yeah. You know, high and dry. He says with an elegant shrug. Okay, so Harry's like trying to be reassuring here. You're a Yankee from way back. Keep going.
The DaCostas, as Harry well knew, were an old Portuguese-Dutch family who had begun assimilating the minute they arrived in the New World in 1800, something like that, and had intermarried whenever an Episcopalian would have them. 50 years ago, Justin studied medicine for the purpose of learning psychiatry. His practice still flourished. He saw patients in a freestanding office, previously a stable, behind their home, previously a farmhouse, the whole compound 15 miles north of Boston. Judith had designed all the conversations,
All the conversions.
Oh, conversion, sorry. Judith had designed all the conversions. The windows of Justin's consulting room faced a soothing stand of birches.
Okay.
So is she playing with words again for a change about conversions?
Yes.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure I was reading
yes.
that right.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Right. Designed all the conversions, yeah. Right. Yeah, that's so beautiful.
So is she one of the Episcopalians they married, is the question.
Or is she
the DaCosta, so is she married into the family? And so was she one?
Right, so is she one?
I think her husband probably is the
her
one.
Her husband is the, right, is the one who, you know, the family intermarried. So, you know, she's maybe Jewish, maybe she's not Jewish.
From the sounds of it, she's most likely one of the Episcopalians
that would have them. Yeah.
Okay. That's a very wonderful paragraph about a lot of stuff.
Yeah, right? So, you know, we know this about American Jews and American Jews' assimilation into the United States of America, you know, and we, for those of you who may have peeked at the Oscars last night, the movie industry, the way the, you know, all of the big mucky mucks in the movie industry, you know, their ideal was the non-Jewish woman, you know, the blonde and so on. So whenever an Episcopalian would have them, what else is implied by Episcopalian?
Well, it's old money.
Yeah.
It's old money, and it was at one time, I mean, it's now a minority, a tiny minority in our
right.
country, but at one time it was the most powerful group.
Right.
They controlled almost everything, if you think about the banks, the learning institutions, the government, other
right.
things.
Yeah.
Right. So they are money and power, you know, possibly.
Maybe the real Americans, because they're trying to assimilate. So
yes.
An Episcopalian will have you then.
Yes. Then
you're
right. The windows of Justin's consulting room faced a soothing stand of birches. A soothing stand of birches. What's that?
So his patients will be comfortable.
Uh-huh, yeah, and so he's looking outside and, you know, and so there's this kind of pastoral little view there. I don't know, the birches.
They're tall and thin.
What?
They're tall and thin.
Yeah. They're tall and thin, just like that.
Yeah.
Right,
that's good.
Right. I don't know. Does anything, yeah.
Well, it implies a landscape that has, in the English way, been designed. I mean, this may look like natural, but, you know, it's designed like a big estate's acres.
Right,
to
right.
To be a garden with trees and everything.
Right.
This is not
right.
haphazard.
But the
right.
soothing part is, I'm not, what's soothing about birches, but if her intent is to have his office be an environment where his patients can be supported or something, it sounds like it's her intention, but I don't get the birch part either.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that she meant this, but I always, you know, I can't hear a birch without thinking of John Birch.
Judith likes to control things completely.
Yeah.
Even the birches.
So
they grow underground.
Right.
You know, they're like mushrooms. Birches are from the same kind of organic, so that they grow colonies underground. I don't know what she's playing.
I don't know.
Don't birches have white
white bark?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. So maybe that's it.
That's
yeah.
It.
Yeah.
That's what I when I first read it. That was what I thought. The soft birch. Yeah.
White Anglo-Saxon. No, just kidding.
White and white.
Okay, Judy, keep going.
I remember the poem by Robert Frost. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I don't remember the content of it, but I remember he wrote a poem called Birches.
Mm-hmm.
50 lines. Most anthologized poems I've ever
read. Okay.
But I don't know.
So it's something also, I mean, if Robert Frost is writing about it, it's New England, it's, you know.
Yeah.
Okay. But let us keep going.
The Savitskys had, you want me to start there?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The Savitskys had visited the DaCostas once, 3 years ago, the night before Miriam Savitsky's wedding to Jotham DaCosta. At that party, they discovered that there were backyards in Greater Boston through which rabbits ran, into which deer tripped, and that people in the mental health professions did not drink hard liquor. Justin managed to unearth a bottle of scotch from a recess under the sink, and that the severe Judith was the daughter of a New Jersey pharmacist. The pharmacist was there on the lawn in a deck chair, aged and garrulous. Harry and his new son-in-law's grandfather talked for a while about synthetic serotonin. The old man had died last winter.
Mm-hmm. So Harry and the grandfather have a lot in common. Why?
Chemistry
and pharmacy, right. So, so what are they talking about? Antidepressants, right? The makeup of antidepressants. Okay. What is that part? The severe Judith was the daughter of a New Jersey pharmacist.
Well, she wasn't the daughter of a stockbroker.
The high pedigree that she would like to think that she, you know, is she's the daughter, right?
An old money.
It's like busted, you know.
Jill, it also makes her sound humorless.
Yeah.
She just doesn't find anything funny.
Yeah, but she's... okay. Go over to 221. The kids' apartment out there, it's adorable. Do you want to continue?
Oh, you want me to... Oh, yeah. No. Next person.
Barry, do you want... Okay. Or, yeah.
Do you want to read?
Yeah.
Okay.
The kids' apartment out there, it's adorable, said Lucienne. With all that clutter, how can anybody tell, said Harry. Mostly Jotham's paint and canvases, that clutter, Justin bravely admitted. Miriam drops her briefcase in one room, her pocketbook in another, throws her keys on the toilet tank, said Lucienne. I raised her wrong in mock repentance.
Okay, so back for a second. So the Savitskys have only been to the DaCostas once in 3 years, right? Once. And that's the night before the wedding, right? So that says a lot. You know, the annual evening out is now a great concession. Okay, so yeah, keep going.
They like their jobs. They both seem happy, said Judith, turning large khaki eyes to Harry. Oh, that's wonderful. Khaki eyes to Harry, a softened gaze. Justin said, they do. And Lucienne said, Duke. And for a moment, the maitre d', if he was looking, the fiddler, if he was looking, anybody idly looking, might have taken them for two couples happy with their connection by marriage.
So you might have thought, if you were looking at them, but don't be fooled.
Yeah.
Right?
Sometimes what looked so became so.
So sometimes you fake it till you make it. Mm-hmm. Not in this case. Mm-hmm. This is not one of those cases.
If Jotham was a bit high-strung for the Savitskys, if Miriam was too argumentative for the DaCostas, well, you couldn't have everything, could you? Many people have nothing, Harry said aloud, startling Judith, alerting Justin's practiced empathy. Yes, the doctor encouraged, and not at all troubling Lucienne, who was on her fifth birthday.
Right, so there's alerting, you know, he gets triggered into his practiced empathy, right? So the appetizers. The appetizers came, four different dishes full of things that could kill you. Every person tasted everything. The Savitskys eager, the DaCostas restrained. They talked about the Red Sox, at least the Savitskys did. The team had begun the season well and would break their hearts as always, wait and see. The DaCostas murmured something. The main course arrived and a bottle of wine. Judith poured, everyone got a half glass. They talked about the gubernatorial, what does that mean, everybody got a half glass?
Oh, it's half full.
It's always, right.
Or is it half empty?
Is it half empty or is it half full? Well, two people got the half empty glass and two people got the half full glass, right? They talked about the gubernatorial race. The DaCostas were staunch Democrats, though it sometimes pained them. No one cares enough about the environment, said Judith. Harry nodded.
He didn't care
about the environment at all. The fiddler fiddled. What I find, it's uncanny how these two people get together and find the least interesting things to say to each other. Yeah, well, you know, you're trying to be on some kind of firm ground, you know? Let's hit the weather, let's hit the sports. You know, nothing's working here. I mean, the Savinskys are trying, but, you know, it's constantly, yeah. The fiddler fiddled. They talked about Stalin. There was a new biography. None of them had read it. And so conversation rested on the easily on the villainy they already knew. You know, we could say, oh, that's, he was so, you know, he was horrific. He was horrific. You know, at least we can be together. You know, at least Stalin can unite them in something, right? You know, that's what it takes. Harry finished the rest of the wine. They talked about movies that both couples had seen, though of course not together. There were some silences. Thea, do you want to keep going?
Lucienne would tell the story tonight, Harry thought. She would tell the story soon. The DaCostas had never heard the story. She had been waiting, as she always did, for the quiet moment, the calm place, the inviting question, and the turning point in a growing intimacy. Harry had heard the story scores of times. He had heard it in Yiddish, and in French, and occasionally in Spanish. Mostly, though, she told it in her lightly accented English.
Okay, so Lucienne was waiting, right? So why was she waiting?
She was waiting for an invitation. She was waiting for some sign that the DaCostas had any interest in who she was.
Right. And so Harry thought, well, you know, maybe this is our third annual evening out. Maybe it'll be tonight. He understands it in all languages. She wasn't technically a survivor, never set foot in camp, but still, bottom of the page. Once, the only instance to his knowledge, she'd awarded the story to a stranger. He'd heard it in the compartment of an Irish train. Their companion was a priest who listened with deep attention. She awarded her story. What does that mean?
It's precious to her.
It's precious. It's a gift. It's not given to everybody. She awarded the story. And why does she award it to this stranger? Right. Because he listened with deep attention. That's what's required for this kind of story. You cannot listen to it with anything but attention. Once she told it at the movies, they and another couple arrived early by mistake and had to occupy half an hour while trivia questions lingered on the screen. That night she had narrated from his left, leaning toward their friends, a pair of lesbian teachers on his right. While she spoke, she stared at them with the usual intensity. Harry, kept in his place by his wife aslant his lap, stared at her pretty profile, her apricot hair, the flesh lapping from her chin. He loves his wife, you know? And she holds him in place. You know, we're talking about she's leaning over to talk, right? And so she's kind of, sort of not quite boring into him, but she is holding him in place. But, you know, she's his anchor in more ways than one. Whatever language she employed, the nouns were unadorned, the syntax plain, the vocabulary undemanding. Not a word that couldn't be understood by children, though she never told the story to children unless you counted Miriam. He could tell the thing himself in any of her tongues. So she knows not to tell the story to children. You know, Miriam knows, but you know, who knows when they told her. But it's not a story that's hard to understand. If you want to understand this story, you can, because she just tells it. There's nothing There's no great mystery to it. I mean, there are some mysteries to it, but not in the words. You can, if you at all wanted to, at all, you could understand this story. Karen, do you want to read it?
I was four. The Nazis had taken over. We were desperate to escape. My father went out every morning to stand in line at one place or another to try to pay the right person. That morning, he took my brother with him. My brother was 12. They went to one office and were on their way to a second. Soldiers in helmets grabbed my father. My brother saw the truck then, and the people on it crying. The soldiers pushed my father toward the truck, and your son too. One of them took my brother by the sleeve of his coat. My father stopped then. The soldier kept yanking at him. Son, my father said, that kid isn't my son. I don't even know him. The Germans still held on to my brother. My father turned away from them both and started walking again toward the truck. My brother saw one shoulder lift in a shrug. He heard his voice. Some goy, my father said. So they let my brother go. He came running home and he showed us the ripped place on his sleeve where they had held him. We managed to get out that night. We went to Holland and got on a boat for Argentina.
So so the story is about, it's about many things, but what is it about?
It's why she's alive.
Okay, so it's why she's here to tell the story, right? And the story must be told, you know, such a Jewish thing. We have to tell our story every year at Pesach time, right? The Haggadah, the telling, there's a sacredness to the telling. This is a story of extraordinary love, extraordinarily quick thinking, just the sacrifice of a father for the child.
But there's a lot of guilt there.
Sure, sure.
By about surviving when the father was at that time the head of the house.
Yeah. So what is it that propels her to tell the story? You know, all of those things, right? This is a story that people should know about, right? This is the kind of story that we can learn from, anybody can learn from. The dessert came, four different sweets again they shared. Lucien said, we'll go to Santa Fe for the holidays. Judah said, we'll go for Thanksgiving. And the kids will come east for ... in December, said Justin. The young couple spent half their vacation with one set of parents, half with the other. More room in their place, Miriam told Harry and Lucien, more food here. The bill came, they paid with credit cards, the nervous waiter hurried to bring their outerwear, two overcoats, and Judith's down jacket, and Lucien's first stole inherited from her mother. Judith, said Lucien, I forgot to mention your father's death. You sent a kind note, said Judith in a final manner. My own father died when I was a little girl, said Lucien, but when my mother died, I was 50 already. Then I truly felt forlorn. Then I felt truly forlorn, an orphan. Dad's life satisfied him, said Judith. The fiddler had paused, a quiet moment. Justin leaned toward Lucien. You were a little girl, he said softly. What did your father die of? Okay, so let's go back to Judith for a second. What's Judith trying to do?
Shut it off.
Shut it down. No intimacy, no connection between us. You know, your father's different from my father. You know, you are different from me. You know, I don't feel forlorn. You know, my father had a good life and so on.
And no thank you for the note.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. I mean, it's just no give and take.
Right.
But it's also different cultural patterns. Episcopalians don't mourn the way Jews mourn. They don't. And it's just, you're looking at two different cultures as well as, so I don't even think it's so much that she's hostile as she just doesn't understand. She doesn't see it. The world doesn't. She doesn't see death and mourning the same way the Jews do.
So they have a big connection, the children.
No, I understand that part, but I'm talking about the cultural connections.
So
they just don't see it that way.
Right. But I, when Judith, you sent a kind note, said Judith, in a final manner, right? At least Edith Perlman is telling us she's cutting off the conversation. Whatever impels her to cut off the conversation, she's cutting it off. Dad's life satisfied him, said Judith. So there was a quiet moment. Now Justin is, you know, he's actually, maybe he's actually feeling something here. You were a little girl. What did your father die of? The patrons were devotedly eating, a calm place, a growing intimacy. Where, he asked. She lifted one shoulder and lifted her lip too. Overseas, she said. She stood up and wrapped herself in her ratty stole, and Harry had to run a little. She was so fast getting to the door. Why won't she tell the story to him?
Because Lucien's there.
Yes. I mean, because Judith
is there. She doesn't want Judith to hear the story.
Mm-hmm. And maybe she also knows it's that practiced, you know, he's practicing all those expressions, all those meaningful
right.
listening.
Right.
They won't care.
Right.
It's be a wasted breath.
Right.
And it's an intimate story. I mean, it shows who she is, and she doesn't want to reveal that to them.
Right.
Also, they're on their way out. I mean, this is not a story you tell on the fly. This
right.
is a story you tell to the priest who's sitting on the train with you, in which you have some time to actually tell the story.
Yeah.
Not when you already have your ratty stole on and your down coat, and not when you're on the fly.
Well, right.
Well, also, she's talking about, you know, when her mother died, when her father died, and the other one, she wasn't interested in any of this, mm-hmm. so why should she open herself up and tell her something so intimate? Because she knows she didn't care. Why bother?
Yeah. So even if they didn't know, their kids have been married for 3 years now. And even if they didn't know this story, right, possibly, there's no way that they didn't know
the whole background.
The background.
Uh-huh.
So for him to say, what did he die of? it's an obscene question.
That's an insult.
It's cruel. You were a little girl. What did your father die of? Are you kidding? How could you be so awful? And where? What do you mean where? You know, there's no. They would have had to work so hard not to know that about.
Excuse me.
Yeah, go ahead.
And she had a little accent, so they knew that English was not her first. English was not her first language, so there's no surprise. They just weren't interested.
They knew more than that.
Sure.
They knew she taught French. I mean, and the fact that they might not have known that French was her native language is inexcusable. I mean, you can't even guess that could have happened.
Yeah. So you know, so she does what the father does, right? The father, he lifts the shoulder, some goy. And that's an amazing act of love, right? But she lifts the shoulder and she lifts the mouth, right? It's a kind of sneer. She would never give this story to these people. They first of all, it would be a waste. They wouldn't even hear it. But second of all, they don't deserve to hear a story like that. You entrust a story like that to people.
But you have to keep trying.
Maybe.
To reinforce the fact that she made a conscious decision not to share her story, if you go back to 222, they talk about the circumstances in which she might share the story. She'd been waiting for the quiet moment, the calm place, the inviting question, the turning point in a growing intimacy. So that I wondered about that sentence. The patrons were devotedly eating, a calm place, a growing intimacy. So those were the elements that usually provoked her to say something, but not this time.
Right. They are not worthy to hear the story. And, you know, she is running out of there so fast. So this the story is, you know, it's something sacred. And you know, she may try to tell it to a lot of people, but she makes sure there are people, they are people who can possibly hear the story, right? And so, but she realizes that, you know, they're not worthy, you know, why should she it's like entrusting her beloved father, you know, to these people who, you know, who don't want to know from her. And so, you know, her father's act, you know, Jewishly, what we say, you save one life, you've saved a world, right? Mm-hmm. Save one life, you save the world. Well, that's exactly what he did, right? He saved her brother, you know, that saved the entire family, because then he could tell them, and they, you know, they got out quickly, and all of their, you know, the children and the children's children, you know, he saved the world. This is a story of redemption, the story that she's telling. And we believe in telling stories of redemption. That's what we do every year. But it has to be, somebody has to tell you, I'm here at the table, now you can tell your story, right? In other words, like, I'm not gonna go run and try to like smash the Haggadah down somebody's throat who doesn't wanna come to a Seder table, right? First of all, they're not gonna be able to hear it. You know, similar here. They kept giving the message, we don't like to be at the same table with you. Yeah.
I read it a little differently.
Go ahead, please.
In terms of the husband, in terms of Justin. When he said you were a little girl, he said softly, what did your... I don't think he knew. And if they really didn't care that much about their daughter-in-law's story, and she, like her mother, didn't want to share it, I think it's possible that he didn't know. He didn't have intimations. And he's a psychiatrist. In fact, before they said, you know, I forget what the circumstance was, he said yes. So he was encouraging one of his patients to speak to him.
Right.
So I think it's she. And then there were times when he was kind of uncomfortable with what she said. I think that the story was not meant to be shared with Judith, and that he was not innocent, but yes. He wasn't the target of this. Okay. I don't know.
I absolutely agree. That's how I took it. When the story starts right at the beginning, Judith says, predictable, and he says, oh, hopeful. I mean, they're very different people who he's learned to tolerate her.
Could very well be.
The other hopeful thing is they go to the kids for the holidays. Now, I would suspect the average Episcopalian reading the story wouldn't know what the holidays were. Mm-hmm. Okay. But since they give the chronology of the holidays followed by Thanksgiving, followed by December holidays, we assume they went for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Okay. So whatever the relationship is between this young couple, at least Miriam is accepting her parents for the holidays. Mm-hmm. And they may be uncomfortable with that too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's
there was one humorous thing when they talked about the kid's house, that her teeth were in the toilet. I mean, I related to that.
Don't we all?
Yeah. So the one thing I couldn't get, and if we ever get in touch with Edith Frohman, I want to ask her. So the name of the son, Yotam. It's a parable from the Bible. I mean, one was a Judean king, but there was this other one who is kind of gives this parable about dictatorships and so on from the Book of Judges. I don't know what it is. I mean, it might be just like, you know, Protestants know their Bible, and you know, it could be that. But
I just assumed it was Greek. It was Dutch, and it had
I thought it was a family name. That was my
exactly.
Yeah.
Could be. Wonderful that the parents could never get together, but the children do, and they go half to one parent and half to another.
Right.
So there's hope.
There could be hope, yeah. So interestingly, so we started the book with how to fall, right? And we end the book with the story, right? And so I think those are actually the two things that this book is about. it's about, because she's always writing both about the content of a story, but also about the art of a writer and writing and language and, you know, and communication and all of those things. So the story, the potential, God bless you. So in this small story, you have the potential that stories have, which is, you know, stories can be life-changing. They can be perspective-changing. They can be, you know, stories are, you know, they give us our identities, and they, you know, it's very, very powerful. And so she's always telling us about the power of stories as she tells the story. But that theme of how to fall, how do you see that, you know, in the book, in all of the stories? You know, if you go back, we've been spending a long time on this book. You know, eyesore and, you know, Franny with the, you know, the, you know, who does her eye purple and so on. The large lady, you know, who comes from Africa to raise money for the kids and so on. The breadth of the situations of these stories is really incredible. But what is, you know, if you're looking at the book in aggregate,
for me, it was how you have these wonderful expectations, and most of the time we have to learn to live with less. And Roman is showing us ways to live with less than what we would like to fantasize in our ideal. And that's reassuring. At least to me, it's reassuring.
Yeah.
I mean, because even if our expectations are appropriate, we don't always achieve them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And most of the times, mine are frankly inappropriate, but you know, I mean, even if they're appropriate, it's very hard to achieve them.
Right. So one of the reviewers talks about how Edith Perlman is interested in this phenomenon called adequate happiness. Mm-hmm. And when you dig a little down on adequate happiness, you find out that actually there's a tremendous amount to be grateful for in that adequate happiness. Great. What else?
Well, that trilogy was just breathtaking. The three stories. I enjoyed it. I got a lot out of the book in general. Madame Guralnik, that was an excellent story.
How you sell diamond on the black market. It's
yes.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And she made do with less. That's part of it. But I felt like I knew these people, like I cared about I really cared about these people,
right,
more than the couple that, what was the story, where they went their own way, and, you know, that was cute. But these people, I mean, I would have liked to write a whole book about these people.
Yeah,
it
yeah.
was wonderful. It was touching and intimate,
yeah.
Very intimate.
Yeah. She forms her characters amazingly in such a small space. Yeah.
She writes a lot about moral courage too, about people making not easy decisions and making them anyway. Some of the people's final choices are really dazzling. Hmm. Certainly the end stories. But all of those stories, the last four or five at the end. But even in How to Fall, I mean, that's really interesting in terms of courage.
In which?
How to Fall.
Oh, yeah.
In first.
Yeah.
Making a decision that's, you just wonder.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, the question for the human condition, for us as people, is not will you fall or won't you fall? We will all fall. And the question is how to fall. How to fall so that, you know, we can get up again. How to fall so that we can make meaning of what has happened to us, which will help us get up again. Go ahead.
For me, it was the word compromise. You spend your life thinking about compromising in different situations. And the thing that these stories told me was compromise can be really successful. You don't feel that way when you're in the different situations. But in the long run, that is success. And it's an unfortunate word in some ways.
So go to the back to the foreword on page XI, right at the beginning. So this is Joanna Scott. In Edith Perlman's story, Signs of Life, two unremarkable women settle in a suburb outside of Boston. They nurture attachments, battle illness, and grow old. Eventually, we can be sure they will disappear and much of their lives will be forgotten. But Edith Perlman suggests that experience, no matter how routine, will be spiced with singular adventures. And evidence of singularity is difficult to erase. No matter what these women do to keep from drawing attention to themselves, they will be remembered through the stories told about them, and the stories will give their audience the means to imagine what has been left unsaid. Another unremarkable couple arrives in the same town. They rent the top of a three-story house on Lewis Street. They work and raise their children. Eventually, they move away, and after they're gone, their neighbors realize that much about the couple remains uncertain. Who were they? Where have they gone? Why do we care? We do care, Edith Perlman insists. In her hands, the uncertainties surrounding the lives of neighbors and acquaintances are as intriguing as the scraps of fact and prompt us to consider what happens when the story is over, right? We're always left, we want to know what happened the next day, right? Edith Perlman manages to combine subtlety with extravagance, understatement with spectacle, drawing our focus to the eccentricities of those who would prefer to remain unnoticed. They were not adventurous. No, no, she writes. Whenever someone suggested otherwise, they raised four protesting palms in negation as if they were under arrest. This is the one who's resurrected, right? Remember that story? Right, nothing special about us. Humdrum appearances fail to disguise individuality. Confronted with the unexpected obstacles, these characters exchange the blurring comfort of routine with spontaneity and improvisation. They fall in love. They fall to pieces. They make secret sacrifices. They take daring risks. They wonder if they have lived justly, fully, completely. They ask themselves questions that challenge complacency. Hell gapes for the merely empathic. That was what Bill was beginning to think in The Large Lady. Wide-ranging in her settings, from the stage of a television comedy to a pawn shop in Istanbul, suburban New England, London during the Second World War, and contemporary Jerusalem, Edith Perlman gives us the means to imagine what is worth remembering. In each of these stories, she honors the simple strangeness of life, the distinctive oddity of sheer persistence, as in the portraits of the women in Signs of Life. They are old women now, remarkable at last, just for being so old, and for maintaining independence and health. Whether the characters choose to settle or move on, resume or change their routines, they respond to the unexpected turns of fortune with passion that is as assured as Edith Perlman's prose. Full of vivid, intricate, nuanced portraits, confidently focused, restrained, and yet spirited, saturated with a powerful, imaginative sympathy, How to Fall is a remarkable collection by a remarkable writer. Mm-hmm. All right.
Edith, in her biography at the end, she said that her hobbies are reading, walking, and matchmaking.
It's great. Okay, no class next week. Yours truly will be in Israel.
That's right.
But class 2 weeks from now.
We'll have an amazing trip.
Great. Thank you.
Have a great trip.
Thank you.
It's wonderful that your whole family is going to be there.
Yeah. Really, really excited about it.
Good. That.
Good fun.
Travel safe.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.